got to keep families together, but you should have facilities that help do that.
Senator Sullivan adds to the national conversation around immigration and family separation. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an unexpected salmon closure in southeast Alaska.
This is by far the worst on record that we've ever seen as far as Keetuck River weir count.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Governor Walker's office on Friday asked the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to suspend the environmental impact statement process for the proposed Pebble Mine. In a letter to the Army Corps, Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott contend that Pebble Limited Partnership has yet to present a feasible and realistic project. For the Corps to fully consider all alternatives in the draft EIS, they recommend a preliminary economic assessment at minimum and preferably a pre-feasibility study. Governor Walker said he believes the project needs to catch up to the process.
The Corps of Engineers is evaluating all the options on Pebble Mine. We want to make sure that there's sufficient opportunity for input on the actual project itself. And we felt that it wasn't far enough along really to warrant this review. I think it's appropriate for them to look at suspending the permit process until the information sort of catches up.
The letter was submitted on the final day of the EIS scoping period. Walker says the next step is for the Corps to decide.
Really, the next step is we don't necessarily have one administratively ourselves that I'm aware of, but really the ball's in their court at this point, how they're going to respond to the information they've received.
Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation CEO Norman Van Vactor called the decision fantastic. BBEDC has long opposed the mining project. In a press release, Pebble Limited Partnership CEO Tom Collier said the purpose of the Corps' EIS process is to evaluate Pebble's potential environmental impact, including whether it would be able to operate without harm to the region's salmon habitat. He said the governor's request to suspend this process was unclear, and Collier says he sees it as a stall tactic. Communities across the country demonstrated this past weekend against the Trump administration's immigration policies, including in Alaska. The protests stemmed from an original wave of outrage at the separation of children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. Protests were held in Juneau, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and in Kodiak. People gathered at the main downtown intersection on Saturday to show support for keeping migrating families together and for a more compassionate approach to immigration policy. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche was there.
Over 30 people have gathered on the grassy triangle at the Y, the center of traffic in downtown Kodiak. Cars honk on the way past. Demonstrators hold up signs saying things like less fear, more compassion, and they are children. Organizer Brianna Peterson says she pulled the gathering together last minute after seeing interest on Facebook. She says she is horrified by the stories of children being separated from their families.
People seem to really be lacking empathy for the situation, and it's just, in my opinion, inhumane to take kids away from their parents.
For the past few months, the federal government has been placing migrant children in facilities established for that purpose. Last week, the Trump administration changed its policy in reaction to backlash from the public. Now, families seeking asylum, mostly from countries in Central America, are being detained together. Erin Manlin sits in the center of the green with her son and says she imagines what it must be like for families at the border.
I have two kids of my own, and, you know, I put myself in the shoes of their parents, of their moms, and it just made me feel sad. It didn't feel right at all. Doesn't matter where you're from, you know. You keep your kids with their parents.
She says no one should be locked up or jailed and suggested the alternative of finding volunteers to give families a place in their homes. That idea also appeals to Michelle Weekly, who says she'd offer her home up if she were in the position.
It's a medieval practice to separate children from their families. But I know it's a big problem. How do you house all these people that are trying to come in? The problem is vast, but as long as we keep our families together.
The United States has a long history of separating children from parents, from the days of slavery to the colonization of Native Americans. During World War II, Japanese American families were held in camps together. Carol Holt sees the administration's policies as a regression.
And, you know, the worst possible scenario is that what Trump is moving toward is detainment camps like this country did with Japanese in World War II. And I don't want us to get anywhere near what we did then. I want us to remember our history, remember who we are, and move the process forward.
Organizer Brianna Peterson says the shift to detaining families together is a positive step forward and believes it's a direct result of public protest.
But I guess we'll see. Once we see the kids reunited, I think that would be a bigger statement from the government.
As of June 28th, about 2,000 children were estimated to still be apart from their families.
It's just awful. And so I think this protest against those actions and what our government is doing, I think it's just really important that we do show up and we have a voice for these people that don't have a voice, and we use our privilege in this way.
Current regulations prevent the government from holding families for longer than 20 days, but the Trump administration is trying to change that. Organizers of the Families Belong Together movement said they'd estimated that over 750 events would be held across the country this past weekend.
That report was from KMXT's Kayla DeRoche. Senator Dan Sullivan addressed the issue in Fairbanks yesterday. He emphasized that the federal government is not currently set up to properly manage a flood of immigrants seeking asylum.
You got to keep families together, but you should have facilities that help do that.
Senator Sullivan says the federal government needs to provide new detention centers and additional judges to more efficiently process a nationwide backlog of 700,000 immigrants.
If you keep families together and expedite the processing, you can essentially tell the mom and the child, okay, you qualify for asylum or you don't.
Sullivan stresses that seeking a better economic life does not qualify immigrants for asylum. Sullivan has co-sponsored two bills addressing the immigration situation. He says has suffered from executive branch policy swings, noting that the previous approach, known as catch and release, was also problematic.
Where you have people who are coming to the country illegally, and then they're essentially saying, okay, come back for your hearing in 4 years. And that's what's been going on, too. Well, guess what? None of those people show up. And when that word gets out that that's happening, then it actually creates a flood of more migrants, many of whom don't qualify for asylum.
Sullivan says the bipartisan legislation he supports will provide a long-term solution to the problem. One of the Republican candidates for governor in Alaska has withdrawn from the race. Scott Hawkins announced today that he will not compete in the August 21st primary. Hawkins, in a statement, said Meade Treadwell's late entry into the race was a factor that significantly diminished Hawkins' ability to win. Hawkins says he was looking forward to a head-to-head matchup with former state Senator Mike Dunleavy, saying they had offered different visions for the state while campaigning. But he says Treadwell's entrance in the race complicated this contrast. Treadwell, a former lieutenant governor, joined the race last month. He and Dunleavy are the highest-profile remaining GOP candidates. Hawkins says he'll support the eventual GOP nominee. Governor Bill Walker, an independent, is seeking re-election. Democrat Mark Begich is also running. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, two missing hikers are feared dead.
The likelihood of survival without their gear is pretty minimal.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. Search offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at Search. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Two hikers missing in Wrangell St. Elias National Park are feared dead. That after searchers found signs of the couple late last week. Park spokesperson Maggie Staggerwald says a footprint and a boot along the Sanford River led to two backpacks
that had identification inside them and match the IDs of the two hikers that are missing.
Steigerwald says the experienced backcountry travelers were dropped off by an air taxi on June 22nd for what was supposed to be a five-day trip.
We believe that they tried to cross the Sanford River on most likely the first day of their trip. The likelihood of survival without their gear is pretty minimal.
Steigerwald says park rivers were running very high before dropping on Friday and Saturday. Ground searchers were pulled from the field over the weekend, but Steigerwald says a park pilot will continue to look for the missing hikers. She says the Park Service is in contact with the hiker's family and plans to release their names soon. Commercial sockeye fishing in Yakutat has been closed due to historic low returns, leaving set netters in a bind until coho and chum season later in the summer. Unlike other salmon fisheries around Southeast, biologists never saw this coming. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The forecast for the sockeye return on the Setuk River was good this year. Managers expected to see around 21,000 fish through the weir by this time, and between 30 and 70,000 by the end of the season. As of Monday, July 2nd, only 2,300 fish had made it back to the river. Fish and game biologist Nicole Zeiser says the low return is shocking.
This is by far the worst on record that we've ever seen as far as Setuk River weir count.
Zeiser shut down the commercial set net fishery by emergency order last week, and Yakutat will feel the effects. According to a report in the Juneau Empire, Yakutat fishermen earn about $1.5 million from sockeye, a huge boon to the town's economy. Subsistence fishing for sockeye on the Setuk, one of the few unlimited subsistence fisheries in the state, has been curtailed to just 36 hours a week from Friday morning to Saturday evening. Although Fish and Game has been forecasting low returns for other species in Southeast this year, especially king salmon, no one saw this coming. Zeiser has her suspicions, but no conclusive answers.
Most of the data suggests that the problems in the marine environment, freshwater systems are healthy, producing plenty of smolt and fry that are going out. It's just something's going on in the ocean that we can't control.
Zeiser says that no connection has been established yet between this year's mysterious sockeye decline in the Setuk and weak runs of king salmon elsewhere in Southeast. Unlike its predator cousin, the Chinook, sockeye eat plankton almost exclusively. Nevertheless, a bad year for plankton can ripple through the food web. This year's adult sockeye entered the ocean in 2013 and 2014, a year which was notable for a potentially harmful climate phenomenon.
When they went out to sea, that was when, the blob formed and had the highest sea surface temperatures on record during those years. And so that could play a factor into what's going on with these species, but it's just hard to say.
Zeiser says she's encouraged by recent improvements in the Copper River returns, but she'd want to see 2,000 to 3,000 sockeye per day moving through the Setuk Weir before she'd consider reopening the commercial fishery. Otherwise, Yakutat set netters, like other Southeast salmon fishermen, will look to chum and coho to save the season. Zeiser says that the average five-year commercial harvest for silver salmon in the Setuk has been about 100,000 fish. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The state of Alaska is proposing changes to the way it taxes parts of the marijuana plant, a move intended to address enforcement and industry concerns. The current tax is $50 an ounce for any part of the bud and flower and $15 an ounce for the rest of the plant. The tax, paid by growers, is imposed when marijuana is sold or transferred from a growing facility to a retail store or product manufacturing facility. The Department of Revenue is proposing new bud categories. It proposes taxing mature bud at $50 an ounce and immature or abnormal buds at $25 an ounce. The remainder of the plant would remain taxed at $15 an ounce. The department is taking public comment on the proposed changes until August 10th. Three U.S. senators were in Anchorage on Friday to discuss how the Small Business Administration can help Alaska companies. The focus was overwhelmingly on how to keep federal contracts flowing to businesses that take advantage of one particular special program, as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
In a windowless chamber in the Midtown Lusac Library, Idaho Republican Jim Risch, who chairs the Senate's Small Business and Entrepreneurship Committee, sat beside Alaska's Dan Sullivan. They were eventually joined by Lisa Murkowski, who was late because of military exercises in the airspace over Anchorage.
I would have been here sooner, but my plane was diverted due to the practicing Blue Angels. That's my story.
The Senate field hearing was largely an opportunity to hear from federal officials and stakeholders in Alaska about how to improve 8A contracting. That's the program to help small businesses that are owned or controlled by what the SBA defines as economically and socially disadvantaged groups, a designation that includes Alaska Native corporations of any size. Rob Wong with the SBA told the hearing he wants to learn how to better serve entities that most utilize the 8A program.
Alaska Natives, Hawaiian Natives, and tribes are our power users of our 8A certification.
In recent years, Congress required the Defense Department to impose extra scrutiny on high-value sole-source contracts awarded to ANCs, which critics complain has made it harder for companies to access lucrative business deals. One of those critics is Senator Sullivan.
You have, and I'm not using this term pejoratively, but the bureaucrats in the agency promulgate an avalanche of rules and red tape to, quote unquote, help.
Sullivan says he wants less regulation in the 8A process because he believes it keeps businesses from even applying to the program because of all the paperwork just to navigate it. A panel of small Alaska businesses gave testimony to the senators about problems navigating the 8A system. The barriers are hardly unique to ANCs. Women and minority-owned businesses say challenges taking advantage of the program are abundant. Among them was Richard Peterson of the Central Council Tlingit Haida Indian Tribes, who says the 8A program is a vital means of support for the work smaller tribes do across Alaska. But there could be some improvements.
We hope SBA will increase its good efforts to streamline and facilitate its application process. Right now, we find the application process fairly cumbersome.
According to data from the Native American Contractors Association, though the total value of 8A contracts is up slightly for ANCs and tribal businesses, the value of sole source and Defense Department contracts through the program is down over the last several years. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Personal information of hundreds of Alaskans may have been disclosed as part of a security breach involving the State Division of Public Assistance. State Health Department spokeswoman Katie Marquette says there has been no indication that personal information on the computer infected with a virus 2 months ago had been used in an unauthorized way. Those who have interacted with the Public Assistance Northern Region offices are urged to take steps to guard against identity theft. Marquette says the department waited to notify the public until it had a more accurate picture of what happened. She did not know how the computer got infected. The department says the breach involved more than 500 individuals, but Marquette did not have a more precise number. Juneau's municipal attorney was one of Governor Bill Walker's three appointments to the bench announced today. As KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports, she wasn't among her colleagues' top choices.
Amy Mead has been the city and borough of Juneau's head attorney since 2013. Later this month, she'll be a judge presiding in Juneau Superior Court.
I have felt very honored to be the city attorney, and I hope I have done a good job for the people of Juneau in this position, and I hope to continue that as a Superior Court judge, and I'm just really honored.
In her career, Mead has been a city prosecutor in Ketchikan and worked on Medicaid issues for Alaska's Attorney General. She replaces Judge Louis Menendez, who retired last week. The Alaska Judicial Council surveyed all 8 applicants and released its recommendations in a technical report. The top 3 ranked were Julie Willoughby and Kevin Higgins, both in private practice, and Hannah Siebold, an assistant attorney general. Mead ranked 4th in the survey of her colleagues in the Alaska Bar Association. But the appointment was the governor's call. He also appointed Thomas Temple to Fairbanks Superior Court and Lance Jonas to Kenai Superior Court. In a statement, Walker said, "Alaska is lucky to have them, and I am grateful for their willingness to serve." It's unclear who will succeed Amy Mead as Juneau's city attorney. Mayor Ken Kelch said Monday that there are some great fill-ins available within the city's law department, but a replacement will ultimately be up to the assembly when it meets later this month. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Seward is a town of just 3,000, but on the 4th of July, it swells to 30 or 40,000. People line the streets, camp on lawns, and fill every restaurant and cafe in town. Many are there to watch Mount Marathon, a race that now attracts elite runners from across the world. For Allison Barnwell, it's still her hometown race. Barnwell grew up in Seward and has finished Mount Marathon more than 10 times. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell produced this profile.
I'm Allison Barnwell. I'm from Seward. I grew up most of my life there. And I've raced in the women's senior division for about 8 years now, and then started out in the junior race, and I've done that for 4 years. My parents are in Seward and my sisters, and so there's a lot of nerves in our house because we have so many runners in our house. You can really get into some trouble quick if you take the wrong path. So the faster way to go is right up a cliff right in the beginning. And then there's like smaller cliffs on the way up. Running down the shale is actually surprisingly easy. It kind of feels like you're glissading or skiing almost. Like you kind of have this soft landing and you squish a little bit and you just move on. So it's really fun. I really love it. You come around a corner, go down your final cliff, which is the most exposed face, and then you turn another corner and there's just a crowd of people. And you've been up on the mountain, you know, there's people up on the mountain, but you're kind of alone. So it's always just a huge shock to look out and be like, oh my goodness, there's a crowd, 5 people deep cheering me on. The first year that I placed really well, like I remember coming out of the trees, and it's kind of hard to tell like where you are in the race when you're down in the trees if you're not surrounded by women. And so I came out of the trees in 4th place, and I remember seeing my mom's jaw drop and her eyes just got huge, and she hardly could yell because she was so excited. We have about a half mile from the base of the mountain to finish, and it goes by really quickly, usually just because you want to get to the end and there's so much energy in the crowd. We have like a great time. We have a lot of friends come into town, and typically there's a few people camped out in our yard and an RV parked in our garageway and just a ton of people everywhere. And it just feels like a hometown race with a lot more excitement and a lot more people.
That was Seward local and Mount Marathon racer Allison Barnwell. Tomorrow, we'll hear from David Norris, who set the course record in 2016 and plans to defend his title on Wednesday. The men's race begins at 11 a.m. on July 4th, followed by the women's race at 2 p.m. A new weather station is being developed to collect data for the Haines Pass. The Yukon Avalanche Association recently secured funding from the Yukon government for the project. The association will partner with the Haines Avalanche Center to install the equipment by fall. KHNS's Henry Leisha has more.
Eric Stevens and Jeff Moskowitz founded the Haines Avalanche Center in 2010. The goal was to establish a local avalanche forecast for the public and a platform for people to share data and weather observations. Since then, Stevens and Moskowitz have been venturing out into the mountains around Haines to collect data on snow conditions for their website's forecast. Weather data for this region is sparse. Stevens says that when they first started, there were hardly any resources for forecasting.
And since then, it's grown quite a bit. We now have a snowtell station up on Flower Mountain. We have our own weather station that we installed, that Haines Avalanche Center installed on Mount Rapinski. And there's a couple of other new stations that have gone online that provide mountain weather data. And that's so crucial for us, is having that real-time weather data from high altitudes, not just the valley floors.
In the winter, many skiers and snowboarders are eager to ride the slopes in the Haines Pass. There are numerous risks while riding in this region, from avalanches to rapidly changing conditions. Accurate forecasts are crucial, but this popular winter recreation area lacks a weather station. Stevens says that the Haines Avalanche Center wanted to install a station there, but focused their efforts on Mount Rapinski because the pass is located on Canadian land. Haines locals aren't the only ones trying to scope out the conditions for that region. Kylie Campbell is the interagency director for the Yukon Avalanche Association. She says that many Yukoners need weather data from the pass as well.
We want to try to make sure that there's as much information for the public, and particularly in such a remote, data-sparse region like Haines Pass. For our community, Haines Junction, you know, this weather station is going to be vital whether or not you're even driving on the highway, let alone using the mountains that are accessible from the highway.
Recently, the Yukon Avalanche Association secured funding for a weather station in Haines Pass. The Yukon government awarded the group $20,000 in Tier 1 community development funding. That will cover the cost of materials, installation, and maintenance training for volunteers. Campbell says that she has been working with the British Columbian government on land use issues because the pass is located in BC. The Haines Avalanche Center and Haines Junction residents have also been working as partners on the project.
So it's kind of an exciting project because it's incorporating for us interprovincial and international relationships for some weather information that never really existed from this region.
The Haines Avalanche Center will help choose the location, install the equipment, and maintain it over time. The station itself is a 10 to 15 foot tall tower with instruments to collect data for temperature, humidity, wind, rainfall, and snow depth. Steven says finding a site with the right conditions can be tricky.
You know, in terms of siting, we're looking for a nice balance between exposure to the wind, so we get good wind data, but not too exposed because then all the snow blows away. So we're trying to find a sheltered spot that's kind of partially sheltered and still exposed to the wind. And that's pretty hard to find.
Right now, they're looking at a spot near Glade Peak, also known as Three Guardsmen. Once installed, information from the station will be available to the public online in real time. In Haines, I'm Henry Leisha.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Isabel Ross in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Zachariah Hughes and Emily Russell in Anchorage, Jacob Resnick in Juneau, and Henry Leisha in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.